Hi, Namulanta Kombo here with some very exciting news. Dear Daughter is back for a new series. I'm putting together a handbook to life for daughters everywhere, full of stories and advice to help navigate life. That's Dear Daughter from the BBC World Service. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today we're talking about the status of women in society. Countries are catching up by implementing laws to enforce equality, but is it enough?
It's one thing to have the laws on the books, and it's another thing for them to be implemented.
Taya, do you want to come back in?
Yes, a law is a good sign of political will, you know, but you then need to put these mechanisms and institutions and budgets behind the law.
Can planting a tree ever be bad?
Trees are good. Make no mistake about that. But trees must also be where they ought to be. Not every environment or ecosystem has evolved as tree systems.
And all eyes on the prize in the fight tonight.
Ghana has nothing to lose. So he's going to go into the ring, not scared of anything because he's a UFC fighter. So if he goes into the ring and loses to one of the greatest heavyweights in boxing, he has lost nothing. AJ is going to go into the ring with a lot of fear and a lot of reputation to protect. He doesn't want to put himself there where a UFC fighter comes into boxing and beats him.
It's Friday, the 8th of March. First, we go to our story on the status of women in the world today. It's International Women's Day, and so very many of us are kind of rolling our eyes because we're wondering whether celebrating these days means anything or changes anything. But it is useful, I think, for us to look at the status of women in the world and how close we are to achieving anything like a level playing field. So, let's turn to a World Bank report that investigated the impact of childcare needs and safety considerations when it comes to the workplace. One of the authors of the report told me that this is the first time these issues have actually been taken into account when considering the lives of women. And according to Teya Trumbich, this sketches a worse picture than we'd previously thought. For instance, women enjoy about two-thirds of the protections men enjoy, a figure which was higher at 77% when we didn't factor in safety and childcare. Barriers notwithstanding, women still achieve great things. Yvonne Akisoya became the first woman mayor to be re-elected in Freetown. Sierra Leone is making strong stands in legislating for women's rights to things like extended maternity leave and access to finance and equal pay. But as you can hear in my conversation with Yvonne and Teya, laws are one thing, implementation is another. Consistent application is the gold standard.
My name's Yvonne Akisoya. I'm the mayor of Freetown. I'm currently in Washington, D.C. at the World Bank, where I'll be speaking at a conference on urbanization and poverty reduction.
And our other guest?
And my name is Teya Trumbich, and I'm the manager of the Women, Business and the Law Project at the World Bank, and I'm also in Washington, D.C. currently.
Teya, I'm going to start with you, and I want us to talk about this recent World Bank report that you led, which highlighted significant disparities between laws and their implementation regarding gender equality.
Yes, so the Women, Business and the Law 2024 is the 10th edition of our study. And for the last 15 years, we've been looking at how laws impact women's ability to start businesses and work in the same way as men. And this year, we are taking it to another level by adding two new indicators, so one on safety and one on childcare. And what we found this year by adding these two new indicators is that the gap is much wider than we previously thought. Women have only two-thirds of the rights that men have globally. And on the African continent, it's a little bit over one-half. And so there's a lot of room to improve the laws in the books. But laws on their own are not enough. You know, we say that writing a good law but not implementing and enforcing it is like writing a letter and never mailing it.
So why did you choose the last two indicators? What motivated that?
Well, we have gotten a lot of feedback on what works and the reason that we are still not seeing the outcomes. Despite reform all over the world, we see still a persistent wage gap between men and women. We see persistent violence targeting women in particular. You know, one in three women globally will experience violence in their lifetime. And so despite strong laws, we're not seeing some of those numbers reducing to the level that we would like to have. The pandemic, I think, was a big wake-up call around the importance of childcare. It raised the awareness and urgency around this issue. And so we started looking at how can governments help provide affordable and high-quality childcare through their legislation, but also the enforcement mechanisms.
Yvonne Akisoye, you are the mayor of Freetown. And you've said that you actually underestimated the role gender played in your post. Just tell us about that. What were you up against?
I think the context in that statement was more from the perspective of being constantly asked during the campaign, my initial campaign back in 2018, you know, if I thought this was a job that a woman could do. And I think I was surprised that it was a question because I had been raised to believe and to know that there's nothing a woman can't do, being one of four girls who was really valued and nurtured by loving and supportive parents. But getting into the position, I suppose it was my first foray into public sector life. And perhaps, you know, I had been somewhat cushioned in the private sector roles that I had played previously. But it became clear that the perceptions, the cultural norms, the societal behaviors, and maybe even expectations of how a woman should be in leadership were things that I hadn't really quite bargained for.
Women in Africa generally are very powerful and they're seen in leadership positions. Was it because it was political leadership that this question was being asked of you?
So who was asking? It was typically journalists.
I do apologize for my tribe.
but even some voters. And I think you've made the distinction about political leadership. So Freetown has had mayors since 1893. And there have been three female leaders. By the time I was running for mayor, there hadn't been a female leader of the local council of the city for almost 40 years. And there had never been a female who was being voted for by the entire city, you know, so voting through universal suffrage. So understandably, there was a question mark in some people's minds as to how this was going to work.
You won twice, right?
I did. I won again in June.
What were the difficulties that you came up against when you were acting as mayor? Or did being a woman actually play into the way you led and people learned from that and supported you the second time?
I think the latter would overshadow the former. And I think, you know, we make the point of equality and the need for equality. But it's also important to note that equality does not mean the same. And I believe that women approach leadership and problem management with a different lens, you know, a lens that is influenced by our own personal experiences of nurturing, you know, so there's more of a tendency for women to perhaps instinctively consider what's going on with youth, what's going on with children, what's going on with the elderly in terms of developing policies. So in the work that we did, there was a big emphasis on supporting women. We invested in urban farming. We built the first ever preschool care for women working in markets. You're not going to succeed in everything. And I certainly know that that's true of my administration. But perhaps what's also true of my administration is that we communicate.
So, Tia, which countries would you say enable women leadership and participation better than other countries on the continent?
According to our new measure, which is a higher standard, we see several countries in Africa scoring very highly. The country with the highest score is Mauritius, with a score of 87.5, which is higher than the global average. And then we have Cote d'Ivoire, Gabon, South Africa, and Togo falling with 77.5. And Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and Zambia are next. So those are the countries on the continent that have the highest scores. And the reason for this is a sustained reform effort. And this year, the report recognizes Sierra Leone and Togo as one of the five countries that have implemented the most reforms in the last year. I think Africa really is showing us that change is possible. It's a region that has had laws in the books that were the furthest behind a few decades ago, but through sustained effort and political will, those laws are changing. What needs to happen next is the implementation of those laws so that we see more women like Yvonne leading cities, companies, and empowering the country to have its full citizenship behind it when crises happen like the one we're facing right now with our planet.
Your report mentions that you've spoken about these countries that have enacted laws, and specifically something that is still being struggled with in this country, equal pay. but very few have actually implemented the measures to address the pay gap. So what are the strategies that countries can adopt to actually bridge this gap and to actually recognize that having a child shouldn't come at a financial cost to women?
No, you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, there are direct ways, such as providing equal paternity leave as maternity leave, so that when an employer is looking at a man and a woman, the cost to them is the same. Providing childcare services for parents so that the woman is not the one that is responsible for childcare. We still see women doing globally more than 2 hours per day of unpaid care work compared to men. And I think the number is even higher in the African continent.
Yvonne Akisoye, Sierra Leone recently passed the Gender Equality and Women's Empowerment Bill. Do you see this bill as being the game changer for women in Sierra Leone?
I think having a gender equality bill is really, really, really important. And it's significant that that has been passed and it provides that sort of baseline. But as Taya said, it's one thing to have the laws on the books and it's another thing for them to be implemented.
Taya, do you want to come back in?
Yes, no, a law is a good sign of political will, you know, putting those words on paper, and words really matter when it comes to laws. But you then need to put these mechanisms and institutions and budgets behind the law. And we have seen, you know, in the African continent in particular, a big role that civil society has played and women's rights groups that have brought issues of violence to parliaments and really made this something that's a very tangible problem that needs to be legislated.
That's Taya Trumbich from the World Bank and Yvonne Akisoye, mayor of Freetown. Now, when you think of combating climate change, one of the first things you might think to do is to plant a tree or plant a million trees. You wouldn't be alone. Pledges by governments, philanthropists and corporate leaders to plant a trillion trees worldwide reflect this. But one study stirring debate between experts online claims that large-scale tree planting projects across Africa is damaging ancient grassland ecosystems. Authors of the paper published in the journal Science say that an area the size of France, however big that is being threatened by forest restoration initiatives taking place in inappropriate landscapes. We decided to test this by approaching one of the projects mentioned in the study. To find out, I called Dr. Clement Ajololo from the African Forest Landscape Restoration Initiative, the project at the center of the study. Hello.
Hi, Audrey, this is Clement.
Hello, Clement. You are also Dr. Ajololo. Am I saying it correctly?
Perfect.
And what are you a doctor of?
I have a PhD in GIS and remote sensing of agroecological systems. I also specialize in grassland systems.
Thank you so much for joining us. And you're part of the African Forest Landscape Restoration Initiative. The plan is to plant trees across 100 million hectares of land by 2030? Is it 100 million?
Yes. The AFR 100, as we call it, is a country-led initiative to restore 100 million hectares of land by 2030.
How big is 100 million hectares?
A hectare, as you know, is about the size of a football pitch.
No, I did not know that.
So we're talking about, yeah.
100 million hectares is 100 million football fields, basically.
Yeah, something like that sort.
All right. The reason why we're talking about this is because an article by researchers from the University of Liverpool and others have tried to understand the scale of tree planting in savannas and grasslands. So would you be planting trees in savannas and grasslands?
Yes and no. If we take the savannas, trees that are well interspaced by grass layers, and those systems, when we say they are degraded, it could be due to a number of factors. So planting trees in savannas and grasslands is also a practice that should be informed by a number of other considerations. For example, the land use. A lot of the savanna landscapes are also communal spaces where local inhabitants are practicing agriculture, food production, and bringing in practices such as agroforestry could help manage those landscapes better.
What the study says they found is that an area approximately the size of France, as far as they're concerned, is threatened by forest restoration initiatives that are taking place in inappropriate landscapes. And they say that 52% of tree planting projects in Africa are occurring in savannas. And they seem to be implying that it's because there's a certain urgency of implementing large-scale tree planting that is prompting the funding of inadequately assessed projects. So I know that that's quite a lot to unpack, but can you explain for our listeners how you respond to that and exactly what it is that you are doing?
Look, tree planting in savannas and any type of planting in grassland system could not be blanketly associated with AFR 100 as an initiative. There are several other country-led practices. The challenge has always been setting up a very robust and strong baseline from where you identify the restoration opportunity to plant trees or restore a degraded area. So planting trees in savannas themselves is not a bad idea. It is about following the principles. So I wouldn't say the article is entirely correct.
So how widespread would you say the practice of planting trees in inappropriate places is?
If we plant trees in landscapes that trees are not ought to be planted from the environmental, ecological perspective, and if we are also planting trees on where land use designations are not appropriate for planting trees, then that would be a violation of those landscapes. So the spread of planting trees across the continent or across the member states that are committed to the AFR 100 will be quite broad. The challenge we are having is often having a very robust monitoring and tracking of where trees are planted. But overall, I think tree planting is across different systems and they ought to adhere to the restoration principles.
So I suppose the question really is it a justified fear that is expressed in the article or is it unfounded?
We need to put it to evidence. So we really have to look at the data that is presented in the article. We have to contextualize the discussion and not use a blanket approach to it. I have read the article and some of the very global observation, the database is indicative. We need higher granularity of data to really put those numbers to test and be able to really defend them. At the moment, I wouldn't say it's the case. There's still a little bit of generalization from the study coming across.
Now, the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization defines forests as areas of land spanning more than 0.5 hectares with trees higher than 5 meters, with tree canopy cover of at least 10%. Now, under this definition, other ecosystems, open space they're called, with trees such as savannas would be classified as forests and they would meet the required standards for restoration, even if they were not appropriate. Tell me, does this definition need to be revised and are people misusing it?
Interesting. Yes, the definition by FAO in terms of tree, if you look at it in its purest state, some countries, especially in the equatorial region, you could really say the entire country is a forest if you go by such a definition. However, this is a guideline. Countries have their own classification of what is a forest and what is not a forest. What is classical forest and what is trees outside forest? And that definition is not something that is cast in stone.
Now, you know, I speak to you as someone who loves trees. I mean, trees I regard as sentient beings. And I have affinities to trees. So I'm just wondering, how much damage does a tree really do to an ecosystem? Aren't trees just intrinsically good?
Trees are good. Make no mistake about that. But trees must also be where they ought to be. So not every environment or ecosystem has evolved as tree systems. So if we put in trees where they're not supposed to be, for example, in some soil types, putting trees in it could also lead to even soil erosion and degradation, because trees tend to also direct a flow of water, the water regime when it rains and so forth. So yes, they are good, but we have to be taking it in context.
And that was Dr. Clement Ajololo from the African Forest Landscape Restoration Initiative. That's the joyful sound of fans chanting in support of the mixed martial arts superstar Francis Ngannou. He's stepping into the ring in Saudi Arabia tonight to face Anthony Joshua. The two men come from different disciplines. Anthony Joshua is a boxer. Francis Ngannou is a mixed martial arts fighter. They're both champions, and the fight is the talk of the town. So we visited their fans and family. Ngannou's uncle is in his home village of Batie in Cameroon.
He's left in the image of not just the Batie community, but also Cameroon and Africa as a whole. He's taken us to the highest levels.
Anthony Joshua's cousin is in Sagamu, Nigeria.
My uncles, also Anthony Joshua's dad, were all tough people. We have all sort of had our own fair share of either street fights or professional fights, and we've never really come out bottom.
There's quite a lot at stake for both these fighters, but perhaps Anthony Joshua, or AJ as his fans call him, has more to lose and more to gain. He wants to become a three-time world champion. His opponent is not a boxer, and he, on the face of it, has nothing to lose, but he stands to gain stripes as a boxer because he isn't one just yet. Ngannou is a mixed martial arts fighter and former Ultimate Fighting champion. But both these men are heavyweights. And I've been discussing their chances with Joseph Abeko, a two-time former bantamweight world champion. We began our discussion with some details about his boxing career.
I would say between eight to 10 years, that was when I started boxing. I retired from boxing, that was a few years ago, so that was like in my late 30s.
So tell me, for people who don't know much about boxing, I do know about boxing because my father and I used to love watching boxing together. What does bantamweight mean in boxing terms?
Boxing has a weight categories that start from light fly, flyweight, superfly, bantamweight, featherweight, lightweight, welterweight, and so on, middleweight, and then it ends at heavyweight. Bantamweight is 53.6 kilogram
in weight. Yeah, of the person,
and then
right.
It's what? 118 pounds.
Right. And heavyweight is usually the category that gets most of the attention, right? So let's talk about the fight tonight. Well, Anthony Joshua versus Ngannou. You have been in the ring and you understand what is at stake. What does this fight mean to both of them? What's at stake for them?
It means a lot to both of them. First of all, Ngannou wants to prove to the boxing world that he can switch from MMA to boxing and he will still become successful just as he was at the UFC. Ngannou has nothing to lose. He has nothing to lose. So he's going to go into the ring with a mind of not scared of anything because he has nothing to lose. He's a UFC fighter. So if he goes into the ring and lose to one of the greatest heavyweights in boxing, which is Anthony Joshua, he has lost nothing. And such fighters can be very dangerous to fight because he has nothing to lose. AJ is going to go into the ring with a lot of fear and a lot of reputation to protect because he has won multiple titles at the heavyweight. So he doesn't want to put himself there where a UFC fighter comes into boxing and beats him. So he has a lot to lose in case he loses the fight. So there's going to be a lot of pressure on Anthony Joshua.
One of them has got nothing to lose and everything to gain, and the other one has got everything to lose and everything to gain because he's fighting for his reputation. They're very different disciplines though, right?
It's going to be a very tough one for Anthony Joshua. When you are a proper boxer and you are fighting someone who is not a proper boxer, it becomes very difficult for you because a lot of things that you expect a proper boxer to do, that person is not going to do those things. Physically strong and physically fit, that means he's not going to get tired and he's still going to be able to take your punches and he's also going to be able to throw punches. So it becomes very tough for a boxer to fight such people.
For the countries that these people represent. Anthony Joshua, from here, but Nigerian. Nganou, Cameroonian. The people in Cameroon are absolutely going crazy about this. What does it mean for the two countries?
West Africa is just proving a point that they are dominating. To see two athletes at the highest top and being the main event in a different nation and the whole world is giving them attention proves that West Africa is on top of the game. We are dominating. Also, they give a big recognition to their country. Nganou is in very, very high spirits. His confidence is very, very high. I would say that a lot of people will even be rooting for Nganou than Anthony Joshua because Nganou just fought Tyson Fury and he did very well. People are going to have more hopes on Nganou than Anthony Joshua.
Tell me this. Now, it's the great Muhammad Ali that said the aim of boxing or getting in a fight is not to get hit. For a lot of people watching boxing, it's not easy to watch somebody being slammed with fists and especially these huge, big, heavy men. Do you think that there are dangers in boxing and that maybe we should reconsider it? As exciting as it is?
Boxing is a noble art of self-defense. Boxing is a sport for the warriors. It's a sport for the passionate ones.
I mean, weren't you scared to get hit?
When you go into the ring, you don't get scared to be hit because you have prepared your body for that. You have prepared your mind for that. And all your focus is on winning. Your focus is not on you getting hit or how hard you are getting hit. But all your focus is on how strategically are you going to go on this fight for you to be able to win at the end of the day. You don't even focus on the pain. You don't even focus on the punches that you are being hit. But the only focus is how for you to win and be able to make your people proud and to make your fans proud.
Who do you think is going to win?
My heart is on Anthony Joshua. I want Anthony Joshua to win. He has a lot at stake right now. He's a boxer, not a UFC fighter. I'm just scared of Nganou because Nganou is going to come into the ring with a lot of weapons that may be very dangerous to Joshua. Anything can happen in the ring. Just as Mike Tyson said, everybody got a plan until you get hit. Anything at all can happen to both of them because they are big fighters with big punches. And it depends on who is going to be able to throw harder and be able to hit on the target. It depends on whoever is going to take the hardest hit and still be able to stand.
Okay. How excited are people in Ghana to watch?
Big fights like this is excitement for Ghanaians. All their focus is on the fight. They want to see. As much as we are rooting for Anthony Joshua, a lot of Ghanaians are also rooting for Francis Ngannou as well because we are our neighbors, we are our brothers.
So boxing shall be the winner tonight?
Definitely. At the end of the day, boxing wins. When boxing is the most gentleman sport, you can argue and get aggressive with each other, but immediately the fight is done, you become best friends. So boxing is going to win.
Well, I wasn't planning on watching the fight, but maybe I might just, in memory of my father, actually. Thank you.
Yeah, nice talking to you.
Lovely. Bye-bye. Joseph Abeko, two-time former bantamweight world boxing champion. Focus on Africa was put together by Lola Schroyer, Kevia Cardoso, Bella Hassan, Daniel Dadzi, and Yvette Twagira Maria. Paul Bachibinga is back and took the supervisory reins from Sunita Nahar. Our technical producer was Chris Kuzaris. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. We'll talk again next time.
As we mark International Women's Day, discover two podcasts from the BBC World Service, celebrating women around the world. Where to Be a Woman is the brand new podcast exploring in which countries women are living their best lives.
And my award-winning podcast, Dear Daughter, is back for season 3. Join me, Namulanta Kombo, as I update my handbook to life for daughters everywhere.
Search for Where to Be a Woman
and Dear Daughter
wherever you get your BBC podcasts.